are Locked On Pistons, your daily Detroit Pistons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
4 seconds left. He's got the ball. He should have it. Isaiah hangs on the ball, flips it up to the Raptors. Detroit is the city of champions again.
Detroit basketball.
No, there's no message. The message is... there's that fact that guys that were in there at the end played hard to everybody, not just Andre. Everybody that wasn't in there at the end, those guys came in and competed, earned the right to finish the game. There was no trying to send a message. We were just trying to find five or six men to go in there and compete and play hard at the end, because that's going to have to be who we are from here on. As long as we're here, is a hard playing team.
And a hard playing team is apparently one that Andre Drummond couldn't be a part of. On Monday night. What's happening? Welcome to the Locked On Pistons podcast, your episode for Tuesday, January the 14th, and we're sinking lower, but this might not be the bottom for the Pistons this season. This is your boy Matt Shook, the host of the Locked On Pistons podcast, a sports writer here in Detroit City covering the NBA for the Detroit News and Associated Press, a Pistons fan and follower my whole life, and a sports newspaper reporter for over a decade as well. Thanks for listening. Thanks for spreading the word about the Locked On Pistons podcast and the Ipsy's Amani documentary. Go look for that on my social media channels. Find it on Vimeo, and watch it. It was released yesterday. We talked about it all yesterday's show, so check that out if you want to learn more from Greg DeLiso and myself. The director is Greg. I was the writer and narrator and other things that I did. Just kind of a guerrilla effort by a small group of people, and we got it all done, and we're very proud about the 20-minute short documentary of Amani Bates from Ipsilanti Lincoln, but I'll spare you the talk about that any further today. But we are going to talk about the details from Monday night. Unfortunately, I was in the house writing it up for the Detroit News. I'm going to give you my three takeaways from that one. And later on, we're going to catch up on all the trade rumors, the updates. I've got some thoughts as well. We'll see what James Edwards of The Athletic had to say in his latest article about it on Monday as well. But give me a follow on Twitter at @Matt_Shook, S-C-H-O-C-H, another underscore after that. Also, the Locked On Pistons Twitter account. And check us out on Facebook at Locked On Pistons - Matt Shook. But the Pistons fall to New Orleans Pelicans on Monday night in overtime on my birthday, 117-110. The second overtime game in three games for the Pistons after they didn't play any in the first 38 games of the season. This New Orleans team, of course, is without Zion Williamson, although I saw a report unconfirmed that he might be playing on Thursday, but they didn't on Monday have Brandon Ingram, J.J. Redick, Derek Favors, Drew Holiday, and still managed to beat your Detroit Pistons on the road. The 10 turnover margin, the Pistons had 9 turnovers as compared to 9 as compared to 19 by the New Orleans Pelicans. The reason 99 is in my head as I shuffle some papers here to try to find you a stat that I saw from the game notes earlier is that the Pistons shot, I believe, 99 field goal attempts, which was the most that they've shot all season. And New Orleans shot 103, which is the most that the Pistons gave up all season. So a lot of strange statistics on Monday night. We know we love these strange statistics here in Pistons land. But Derrick Rose had a great fourth quarter, brought the Pistons back from a 16-point deficit with about 11 minutes to go, tied up the game late, and could have won it late with a near buzzer beater for the second time against New Orleans this season after beating them with a mid-range jumper in the Big Easy, but ended up missing that shot on Monday night and missed a few shots late in regulation as well down the stretch, and then two costly turnovers in overtime as well. Derek finished with 23 points, 8 assists. Again, more good than bad in the traditional sense, no doubt about that, but some bad moments late that ended up helping to cause the undoing of the Pistons, but they wouldn't have had a chance to give their own undoing into overtime if it weren't for Derek Rose. Got that? We'll talk about him a little bit more later. But 18 points for Christian Wood and 9 rebounds. He was excellent against his former team. We always talk about him playing in New Orleans last year, but worth keeping in mind that Christian Wood played 8 games for New Orleans last year. So it's not like he's played with them all last season or is a big part of their program. They picked him off of waivers in March, played him 8 games. So let's not overstate the history of Christian Wood and the Pelicans. Although we're getting waived, there's a little bit of a show FU factor that you get when you play against a team like that. But other than Wood, everyone else kind of meh. Sekou, I guess the good news is that a 16-point game from him a career high, tying his career high, is a good sign that I'm not like doing cartwheels over that. It's just kind of what we are starting to expect from Sekou Doumbouya. Probably one of his, you know, second or third best game he's had in this stretch of not many games. But just the fact that I saw Joe Truck on Twitter put it this way, that he's the best wing on the Pistons. And let that sink in, first of all, because it's equal parts pretty cool for a 19-year-old rookie, but also pretty pathetic and bad. But 13 for Sofia Mykhailiuk in a start, 12-5 for Bruce Brown in just 21 minutes. More on that later. 11-10 for Andre Drummond in 22 minutes. Definitely more on that later. But the Pistons fall to 14-27, a new low watermark of the season, 13 games under 500, 41 games in. We are halfway home with the season, if you can believe that. Seems like it's been longer than that, though. Am I the only one who thinks that? This team, with 14 wins at the halfway point, if you're a math major, you know that that makes you on pace for 28-win season. Not great. That would be the worst 82-game season the Pistons have had since 2009-2010. 27-55 that year, that was John Kuster's first season with the Detroit Pistons. So good times all the way around. They had less than 28 wins a couple years after that, but that was the lockout shortened year. The winning percentage was better. So this would be the worst winning percentage since 10 years ago, 2009-2010, and we all remember how those great years went. Pistons 5.5 games out of the Eastern Conference playoffs now, tied with Chicago, virtually tied with Charlotte, just percentage points behind the Charlotte Hornets. So great times. And even that, the pipe dream, the snickering we do after how bad this team was, and they're still, you know, 2.5 or 2 games out of the Eastern Conference playoffs. Well, now it's 5.5, so we can kind of stop that pipe dream and start thinking about the lottery pick more and lottery odds, tankathon, all that good stuff. Of course, before we get all into that, there's a big trade deadline season coming up that's going to be the focus of our podcast over the next few weeks. We know that. But on the court up next, the Pistons will be on the road for 3 games. This is crazy. This is a 3-game losing streak they just had. They are 1-3 since I broke out this stat, and I warned you guys for weeks that they were going to maybe go on a run of wins here, and it might mess up the thought process going into the trade deadline. But no, I assure you that is not happening at this point. 1-3 in this group of games where I was like, these guys might mess around and win like 8 of 11 or 7 of 11 or something like that. They might go 7-4 over the next 11 games. Well, 1-3 later, and I'm starting to doubt my thoughts that they might get hot here, despite the fact that they're not good, but they were playing such bad teams. But 3 games up on the road up next. You think this team could beat anybody on the road? We'll see. Certainly, they won't be Boston on Wednesday, but they're going to be at Atlanta on Saturday for the even more pathetic Hawks in a game that could be a little bit dramatic with Andre Drummond being tossed around in trade rumors. Also, Monday at Washington, that's going to be the MLK Day matinee. Got a couple of guest hosts lined up for you guys on Monday and Tuesday for the show. Looking forward to hearing what those guys have for us. We'll line up some interviews as well. So, yeah, busy times for me before I get out of town this weekend. Head up to the Pacific Northwest, to lovely Oregon, and spend some time up there for a long weekend. But up next, before we start going on getting our minds on vacation, I'm going to be at the practice Tuesday, writing up the game for the news from the couch on Wednesday. And then Thursday, I'm going to be at practice as well. So you can look for all sorts of good content for me on the show and also in the pages of the Detroit News and DetNews.com. But up next, got the 3 big takeaways from Monday night against New Orleans. That's coming up next here on the Locked On Pistons podcast.
Yes, sir!
All right, it is getting kind of late, and I'm just going to kind of blow through some of these 3 biggest takeaways. Not a lot of factual evidence today, not that you ever really expect much here on the Locked On Pistons podcast, but I'm going to kind of go with some gut feelings on some things here. Let's get to the 3rd biggest takeaway. And I'm not going to let Tony Snell's game sneak by today. He was scoreless in 28 minutes, 0 for 4 from the field, 2 rebounds, 2 assists. Feel like his lack of contributions to like anything often go under the table, under the radar a little bit, and they shouldn't. We should be talking about starting small forward Tony Snell. Now, I knew coming into the season that both things were true. Tony Snell coming to the Pistons meant that there was an upgrade at the small forward position for the Pistons because they basically had Sekou, and that's it at small forward, and unless you want to consider, you know, guys that Sofia Mykhailiuk is a small forward, or even if you want to say Luke Kennard can be a small forward sometimes. It's a little bit of an arbitrary term to call someone something. But Tony Snell, yes, upgrade for the Pistons at small forward. But yet, if Tony Snell is your starting small forward, which he probably should be and could be until Sekou, you know, I know he's playing more four in terms of his starting spot and most of the time on the floor, by the way. But Tony Snell is the worst starting small forward in the NBA. There's really no way around that. He's like a replacement level player. He's just not really bringing anything to the floor. Despite the fact that he's having, I mean, I could look it up right now. He's having what an above average shooting 3-point season, which is what you expect from him. He's an above average 3-point shooter. It looks good when it goes. He's had like 3 or 4 games where he's played really well and knocked down a bunch of threes. But like, just there's more games than not where you're like, wow, is he out there? Is he doing anything? Below average defensively. Before going into this game, he's shooting 42.7% from three. And it's like normally if any NBA player is out there shooting 42.7% from three, he'd be like a fan favorite in today's NBA. But it's just like, wow, he's just like supremely ineffective out there. Again, 0 for 4, 0 for 3 from three. 28 minutes, a minus 12, 2 fouls, 1 steal, 1 assist. I mean, he's not even doing enough to get turnovers. He has 0 turnovers because he's not really like making play. I don't want to shit on Tony Snell all night, but man, it's crazy. And that being said, I mean, we all thought the John Luer trade was such a steal, but then what they did with that 30th pick, turning it into 4 seconds and then like pissing away two of the seconds right away. And Jordan Bone, I know we get excited about Jordan Bone a little bit here, but I'm not someone who's really excited about Jordan Bone in terms of being like a piece for anything. But I mean, you know, I could be wrong, but we'll get more into him as the season goes on. We'll watch a lot of Jordan Bone here in these next 41 games, probably unfortunately. But man, Tony Snell, you can see why Milwaukee wanted to get off that money. And looking at the cap numbers for the Pistons next year, assuming Andre Drummond is dealt, Tony Snell is going to be the second highest Piston by a lot. You know, assuming, you know, there are some free agents that will probably take up that slot if Andre is gone. But man, and also get prepared. Vince Ellis wrote a story about Christian Wood getting his guarantee picked up, and he talked about how, pointed out that the Pistons have his early bird rights, which means that the Pistons can re-sign Christian Wood, who's an unrestricted free agent, while being over the cap. You can't bring in other teams' free agents while you're over the cap, but you can do it for your own free agents. But the rule for early bird rights players who are people who have been under their contract for 2 years, and even if you're waived, like Christian Wood was, it still counts as just like a trade would, in that your early bird rights are traded. But be prepared for a world that, because of this stipulation, and if that's the way that they intend on re-signing Christian Wood, be prepared for a Christian Wood 2 years, $20 million player, maybe just under $20 million in terms of the average NBA salary, and at least a 2-year deal is what they're going to have to pay him. Christian Wood, nice story, good player, 24-year-old, kind of giving him some direction. But, man, and I'm not saying it's a gross overpay for Christian Wood, but it's an overpay. And I'm just the context of Christian Wood's season and his game, and hopefully it develops and it becomes the potential piece. And I'm not saying don't bring him back for that kind of money, but there's a big difference between Christian Wood as a $1-something million reclamation project and $9.8 million player or something like that. So that not great when you think about it in that context. But you know, Tony Snell, perfect for a team like the Pistons who thought they would need that piece to be competitive this year. Blake Griffin, if you assume he's healthy, Reggie Jackson's healthy, and that this team is fighting with Orlando and Brooklyn for that 7th, 8th seed, maybe even best case scenario, they're climbing up to the bottom of that next group and going for the 6th seed. Yeah, Tony Snell is a useful at times player, but given where this team is at, had they known, obviously had you known these injuries were coming, there'd be a lot of things they would have done differently this past offseason. Of course, they should have known that there was going to be some kind of injuries coming to some degree. But, man, that Tony Snell contract, you can see there, it's very obvious why Milwaukee made this move when maybe we didn't think that right away when the deal happened. But my second biggest takeaway, let's go with Andre Drummond in this one. It was as ugly live as it seemed on television. Jahlil Okafor playing like it's the 2015 Final Four, just doing Andre Drummond over and over again. Drummond, you know, just kind of not playing defensively very well, not passing the ball offensively as well, turning the ball over 3 times in 22 minutes per usual, 5 for 14 from the field, going up, just trying to dunk a lot and missing dunks. It was someone in Andre who was very clearly frustrated, and someone in Jahlil who's like really excited that he's going up against a player who's really frustrated, really excited that he's going up against someone who's just going to kind of like play big man ball with them. And Jahlil Okafor, like that's his one thing he can do. He can play back to the basket. He's like an elite pivot player, which is like an old school term because it's not even a thing anymore to be like a pivot player, to be someone who can like Al Harrington and Kevin McHale and stuff like that, those kind of guys that have post moves and can do post plays. So Jahlil Okafor is like the one guy who can still do that stuff. It's awesome when you're at Duke and when you're in the Final Four, but not so awesome these days. So it's like Jahlil Okafor is like feasting for the first time in years. It almost had a career high just in the points he scored in the first half. And Andre just got made to look silly. And there were times that he wasn't crossing half court and not in even straight transition situations. Not like it was a slow walk up the court and then Andre wasn't coming. I mean, you'd see those clipped by some of the Andre haters on Twitter now. But there were times where it was like a bit of a transition and Andre just like, not only did he not cross half court, like he wasn't even interested in doing it at any point. Still managed to get 10 rebounds, so that kind of tells you sometimes about those rebounds, I guess. But he had a couple moments. Let's not pretend he didn't. But obviously there was enough issues there where Dwayne Casey sat him down, rightfully or wrongfully. But it's not going to be pretty the rest of this time that Andre Drummond's on the Pistons. And as we talk to other folks and we read James's articles and some of the other stuff we're seeing around the league, it does kind of feel like the Pistons front office is just throwing SHIT against the wall and seeing if something sticks. Like they're getting calls from teams probably, but they're really not that serious of calls. And us thinking we're going to get first-round pick and expiring contracts, probably not even going to happen anymore, especially with the way that the Drummond's kind of behaving on the court. You know, he got kicked out of the game on Saturday. It was worse on Monday when he gets dominated by Jahlil Okafor. So the trade value continues to go down. There was no other way that this was going to go. Andre Drummond and the Pistons' situation for 8 years has been a bad one. It's been a bad marriage. There's equally at fault. The organization has been horrific. Andre Drummond has been imperfect, and his role is overstated because of necessity on the team, especially this season. We're seeing it it's so obvious that it's like embarrassing. It's not embarrassing. That's the wrong word. It's so obvious that it's like you'd be a fool to not admit that Andre Drummond is not equipped for this role that he's being asked to play, which is again not his fault, but it's just kind of emblematic of everything that's gone on for the 8 years that he's been here. And again, how could the Andre Drummond era end in a satisfying way? There's just no way that was going to happen. So of course it's going to be some pouting. Of course it's going to be some benching. Of course it's going to be some blaming from the fan base, rightfully or wrongfully, that he had some part in his trade value getting worse and worse as time goes on. And to the point where, like I said, they might just be dealing with expirings and a second round pick at this point, unless the Ed Stefanski in the front office can turn this whole thing around going forward. But the first biggest takeaway from the game today is I was listening to Laz and Ben on the Detroit Bad Boys podcast. I talk about those guys all the time. I plug that show up and down, and I've heard them mention my name before too, so I appreciate that. Appreciate the Detroit Pistons podcast community, those guys, maybe mostly in particular because it's a smart show that does a good job every week on a smart website that you guys should be checking out as well, by the way. But they articulated something that I think that I've kind of said before in the past, bits and pieces here and there, but like I said, either maybe I haven't and I've just thought those kind of things, or I have and like it's been bits and pieces of it throughout different shows and stuff like that. But they articulated the Derrick Rose argument really well. And they and Laz just kind of came out and said at the beginning, Ben agreed with them too, and I think I agree with those guys completely, that Derrick Rose is, again, and I say it all the time too, and I mean it, Derrick Rose has been great for the Pistons this year. He's been everything you asked for, everything you wanted when you gave him that contract. He's been healthy, all that stuff. But like when Derrick Rose is doing isolation plays at the end of the fourth quarter and into overtime, who is this helping? Who is this getting better? I know that Sekou being out there for defense is good. Other guys being out there for defense is good, too. And Christian Wood working with him with a little bit of a two-man game kind of helps him out, too. So it's not a zero. But in terms of getting these crunch time minutes, Bruce Brown played well on Monday. I don't know why he played 21 minutes and why you're pushing Derrick Rose up to 36 minutes. I know that a lot of that's because of overtime, and you probably want him in those extra 5 minutes. But now you're playing 31 and a half minutes, turns into 36 and a half minutes into overtime. You're supposed to have this 30-minute restriction. Now that the season's over, and there's a real good argument to be made that losing games is better than winning games at this point, this is when your head coach decides to push the minutes limit? Are you insane? Like, Dwayne Casey, and you know, he gets asked about it all the time. He goes over 30 minutes. Duncan, in the postgame, asked about him today, and it turned into kind of a laughing fest. And, you know, we're reporters that are doing our jobs, and everyone needs to ask, and he needs to do whatever he can to package his bad decisions in a good way. But, man, it's not that funny, you know, to see Derrick Rose's the Pistons, you know, trade possibilities being hung out to dry like that, Derrick Rose. And you know, I get it, the competitive nature of it. Dwayne Casey is kind of a player's coach at the end of the day. And he said he felt fine and all that stuff. But, like, it's just the inconsistency that we've talked about on this show that is one of the things about Dwayne Casey that drives me a little crazy. That last year, load management was not a thing at all, right? And then this year, there's all these strict guidelines on Derrick Rose about how many minutes he can play, and yet he goes out and plays a couple back-to-backs sometimes. I liken it to the shot spectrum that, like, Dwayne Casey found out about something and learned something and adapted his coaching style, and it's a good thing, but it's like he robotically made that the tenor or the whole, like, center of his whole basketball philosophy in some ways. And again, I like that. I like the adaptability, but, like, what are your principles, man? Like, if last year you were someone who didn't at all believe in load management, and now this year, for the time of the season that the Pistons are, like, we're trying to win and we're trying to be good, then load management's, like, this big thing. And now Derrick Rose, when, like I said, objectively, this team should probably be definitely should be trading Derrick Rose and Andre Drummond and players that might help you win. And now we're playing that guy 37 minutes and running isolation plays that, while they may be your most effective way of winning that game, of scoring on that possession, A, that's not even what you want, and B, the failure of some of the younger players in those kind of situations could be beneficial for this team. And I feel like I'm just screaming into the ether right now, because I know you guys are probably sharing my opinion on all this stuff, especially maybe not. I mean, I know there's some people out there that still, like, don't want to trade Derrick Rose. I think that's completely insane, and I don't know what you're thinking if that's the situation. Unless you're kind of just saying, hey, this team's going to always suck, and at least I kind of like watching Derrick Rose. I can respect that. But as far as, like, team building, if you think, like, keeping Derrick Rose is a good move when obviously he's as valuable of an asset as he'll ever be, and what does it get you when he keeps playing with you for the next 2 years? And or the next year after this one, and then he leaves as a free agent and clears up $7 million of cap room. That's not really that useful for the Detroit Pistons. But anyway, we've talked about that enough, plenty too. A little frustrated and long day for your boy. But let's take a break, and we're going to talk about some of these Drummond trade possibilities and what James thinks the two teams are that are most likely to end up dancing with the Pistons in a trade for Andre Drummond. And that's next year on the Locked On Pistons podcast, which is a proud member of the Locked On Network, your team every day. Now, I like James Edwards III's article from The Athletic about trading Andre Drummond on Monday, so we're kind of going to go ahead and parse through it and do the old thing where I just read Athletic articles, and they're free for you, so you don't have to get the subscription like I do. But he kind of went through team by team. He didn't include Dallas, which I thought was interesting, because that's a team that I would at least put on the semi-interesting scale as far as how a deal might or could be able to get done between the Pistons and the other team for Andre Drummond. But he broke it down with teams that didn't make sense. Had Cleveland Cavaliers on there. Question being, why would Andre Drummond want to sign long-term if he gets traded to Cleveland? So why would Cleveland give up an asset for a guy that might not stay there long-term? New York Knicks, the biggest reason that James points out as the why this won't work out is because they have Mitchell Robinson. He's younger. He's probably going to be, I don't know, he's not better, obviously, now, but the hope is that it's more valuable under a rookie deal, certainly, and the hope is that it becomes a guy who's more valuable than Andre Drummond, apples and apples. So Yeah, it doesn't make sense that they wouldn't want to trade their young piece for Andre Drummond. That would favor the Pistons too much. And since they want to hold on to him, why would they want the roster duplication that would be created by Andre Drummond being in New York? He went into the Boston Celtics, and it's something we've talked about on the show. Yeah, Boston's got all these picks that would be enticing for the Pistons and really kind of expendable for the Celtics in deals. And I think that there is a deal out there between the Pistons and the Celtics when talking about a guy like Langston Galloway or Derrick Rose. I think that they could get to one of those salaries with their hobnob of small contracts and rookie deal type of guys that they want to get rid of, or the Poirier guy, or just some guys that they want to see be gone, and then have the pick be that best asset. Because, I mean, it's Boston sitting here with three first-round picks for next year, with Memphis being more disappointing by the day in terms of where that pick's going to be, their own also, and then Milwaukee's also in addition to that. So what is the Boston Celtics, if you look at their roster, what are they going to do with three first-round picks in a bad draft? I mean, they've already kind of got a logjam of developmental guys and rookie guys and Taco Fall and Grant Williams and Romeo Langford and Poirier and Carson Edwards. It's like, when are you ever going to find time for those guys to get NBA minutes where you can find out if they're going to be good or not? Now, I'm not saying they're going to get rid of all three of their first-round picks, but that makes that one of them expendable. You probably stash someone at some point, but it just becomes I think they probably trade down and turn it into second-round picks at some point. But I don't see the Boston Celtics walking away from the first round next year with three players without doing something, especially a thing that could help the betterment of their team. But the problem is you got to match salaries, and for Andre Drummond's $28 million deal, they just don't have salaries that make sense. Marcus Smart and Gordon Hayward kind of being the only two that could be the centerpieces of deals that work. I don't think you trade Marcus Smart for Andre Drummond. And Gordon Hayward, I think it's a little bit more likely than Marcus Smart, but, man, that's a $34 million commitment for the Pistons to make next year if Hayward picks up that option. And then, you risk that Drummond leaves. And if you're the Celtics, do you think Andre Drummond's better than Gordon Hayward anyway? All questions that probably make me agree with James that that's probably not possible, too. I would add the Mavericks into this category in between teams that make sense and teams that don't make sense. I don't believe the deal is going to get done with Dallas, but I think that they have, like, those medium-range salaries. Dwight Powell and Maxi Kleber being guys that are under contract for a little while. So they're kind of like that in between. They're not expirings. We know that the Pistons probably would value the cap space, but you get a little bit of an expiring of someone coming off the cap. You get a useful kind of player in Kleber or Powell. So you kind of split the difference there. You get one expiring, and then maybe one of those players as kind of a decent little asset for a couple more years. But then you're talking about second round picks, because Dallas doesn't have the ability to trade any of their first round picks over the next 5 years. They don't have two of them, and they can't trade the other three because of the Stepien rule. But maybe there's a long-term type of player like Tim Hardaway Jr. that becomes that second piece that you think is an asset. So I think that's – it could happen. But as James writes in the article, the teams that make the most sense are the Atlanta Hawks and the Charlotte Hornets. We talked about the Atlanta Hawks. We know why it's a possibility. But the fact that there might just be one, maybe two teams that would even covet Andre Drummond means that the Pistons are at a disadvantage at the negotiating table. And from what Sam Amick reported for The Athletic – and what the winds of change seem to be kind of implying is that it might be tough for the Pistons to get that original package that we had heard about of Chandler Parsons and the Brooklyn picks. So that might even be something that might be far-fetched at this point. And you know, if you listen to the show, that to me was a C- at the time, even just that. But sometimes you got to take that C-, like some of you bad students out there know, and that might be what has to happen. So as far as Charlotte, though, James had his deal be a Biombo and Kid Gilchrist both being expiring deals to match the salaries, and throwing in Markieff Morris with Andre Drummond for their trouble. I don't know that having the Hornets give their first round pick to make that deal happen sounds a little far fetched to me, that you'd get the Hornets first round pick, just because they're probably outside the lottery. I mean, they're probably outside the playoffs, so they're in the lottery. There's a chance that could be a top four pick. There's a chance they flatten the odds. So not only are you giving up what could be a decent player, you're also giving up that chance of what could be a pretty good player, even in this draft. But I don't know. You know, the Pistons, that would be the best case scenario, obviously, to end the to get the Hornets first round pick better than the Brooklyn one with that chance getting the top four, and then purely expiring deals, and not only expiring deals, but Biombo and Kid Gilchrist. John Hollinger, The Athletic, wrote in a story the other day that killed Kid Gilchrist for some wacky salary cap reasons. There might be some value in Kid Gilchrist. He's not a guy who even plays for the Hornets, but because of his contract number, there's ways that teams that have trade exceptions that could be used before the deadline. If you acquire Kid Gilchrist's $13 million contract, you can use that as what is known as a stepladder, where you can acquire more costly deals with Kid Gilchrist's number as opposed to lower numbers, but you could use lower number deals to get Kid Gilchrist so that you could flip him for other players. So, again, way over my head. I'd be deep into the Larry Kuhn FAQ CBA for that. But apparently people who are in the know seem to think that there's a little bit of value with Michael Kidd Gilchrist. So it could be a little bit of an added benefit, especially if the Pistons front office proves to be savvy. And that's, like I said, as bored as I am with this front office at times over the last couple of years, when they are forced to make moves, they seem to make pretty savvy ones. So I am holding out a little bit of hope that that will be the case again. Ed Stefanski will kind of pull a little ace in the hole out of his sleeve and see what happens with it. So that's it. We've gone way long. It's deep into the night. This is your boy Matt Shook of the Locked On Pistons podcast saying, let's do it again tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, everybody.